Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
This is The James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. I'm here until 3:30 p.m. I'm talking about all the biggest stories of the day, of course, and also talking about some pretty interesting interview from Kevin Nolan earlier today, which you may or may not have seen, or heard, I should say, on Talk Sport, our great friends over the road, as we call them. Newcastle fans really have been through the ringer. When you think about it, Chelsea fans too have been through the ringer, but in a slightly different way. And the reason I draw that comparison is because the reason that Maurizio Sarri was unpopular, I understand, or at least Chelsea fans tell me that the reason Maurizio Sarri was unpopular was that he didn't connect with the fans. He won a trophy, he finished third, he was successful, but he didn't connect with the fans and therefore they didn't like him. Newcastle finally got a manager who connected with the fans after, for so long, the club not being close to those loyal supporters. You know, they get 50,000 every week, and more, by the way, at Newcastle. But because of the ownership, because the fans had become disenchanted with the ownership, there was this rift emerging between club and fans. Rafa Benitez healed that rift. Came in March 2016, spent 3 and a bit years at the club, and he helped heal that rift. Now, he connected with the fans, he was loyal, he loved the club, clearly. He fought through all the nonsense that goes with being a Newcastle manager, and then they wouldn't keep him on. They wouldn't bow to his demands, which were not, by all accounts, that unreasonable. Usually you can't find anyone to defend Mike Ashley, especially after he's just got rid of a manager that he actually quite liked, or that everyone else seemed to quite like. But that's exactly what TalkSport did this morning. They found Kevin Nolan, who said that he backed the work Ashley had done at Newcastle.
When he first went, he had all, you know, great intentions of, you know, putting Newcastle back on the map. And I think, obviously, he's lost that now, and he wants to sell it. You know, there's no sort of two ways about it. He wants to get out. But I think what he's done, he's still been able to finance the club and make sure that everything's still running smoothly. You know, you go up there, it's a fantastic club, and what he's done within the ground is fantastic.
I apologise if you're a Newcastle fan, you're listening and you're having a lunch, because I imagine you just spat it out again when Kevin Nolan said he's managed to keep the club running smoothly. Is it running smoothly? Is everything running smoothly? The team has stagnated. They won 12 games in the Premier League last year, just as they did the year before. They went out in the fourth round of the FA Cup last season, just as they did the year before. And they went out in the second round of the League Cup, just as they did the year before. It's unbelievable. Iosi Perez was their top scorer, just as he was the year before. If you want to find, by the way, and he only got 13, if you want to find a Newcastle striker who has scored more than 15 goals, you have to go back to Demba Ba. If you want 20 goals, you actually have to go back to Alan Shearer. This is a team that has stagnated from a footballing perspective. The club is going nowhere in football terms, and it's going nowhere, by the way, in business terms either. Mike Ashley says he's desperate to sell the club, but somehow he has not managed to do so, despite it having a mammoth fan base, a place at the highest domestic table in football, and a famous name. Newcastle United are a club everyone knows all over the world. So is it possible that Ashley quite likes having a business that's making a profit, and also doubles as a billboard for Sports Direct? Yes, I think he probably does, and that's not illegal. That's fine. He enjoys having that business. It works for him. He makes money out of it. That's fine. That is all very much above board. But what is two-faced about it is his claim that he's trying to sell the club at the same time as failing to do so. That doesn't hold water, because realistically, this is a Premier League football club with a lot of selling points to it. Mike Ashley is a salesman. That is how he's made his money. He sells products in Sports Direct. He sells products in House of Fraser, or not, as the case may be these days. But you know what I mean? He's a businessman. He shouldn't find it this hard to sell what is a highly popular product. It's a two-faced claim. It's a product that people want to buy, so surely Ashley should be able to sell it. And I think it probably sits rather badly with Newcastle fans when Kevin Nolan, a former player at Newcastle, says he's done nothing wrong and that's just the way it is with Ashley.
With Mike, you can't fault him. Look, we had a bit of dispute with him years and years ago when I was there with the bonuses as players. You know, we wanted X amount. He was like, "This is what you're having, and if you don't want it, then don't sign it." And that's the way he is, I think. And I think he's been like that now for the last 10 years. So I think when I was there, so I don't think he's ever changed.
I think he probably hasn't changed. And yet, Kevin Nolan seems to think that that negotiation went well for him and that was a fair negotiation when he said, "No, we don't like this contract." And Michael Ashley said, "Well, tough, you sign it or you don't." Worst of all for me, actually, is when you hear Nolan on TalkSport this morning digging out Rafa Benitez, a well-respected manager. I don't know many people, apart from those weird Chelsea fans, who've got a bad word to say about Rafa Benitez. He's been at the highest level for most of his career. He's accumulated trophies all over Europe. He's stuck with Newcastle even when they got relegated, when he wasn't given any money to spend on the team, when it didn't feel like he should be able to achieve a top-half Premier League finish, which he did, by the way. And yet, all of that is still not good enough for Kevin Nolan.
The whole Rafa Benitez thing with, you know, I think he knew what he was going into when he first walked into that club, because Mike is not one who will move the goalposts. This is what you get, this is what you're going to have, and this is what I want you to work with. And I think Rafa's done quite well in working the media in terms of the way he feels and what he wants.
Kevin Nolan there accusing Rafa Benitez of working the media. Funny that, when he's appearing on TalkSport talking about how he can't get back into management. He can't get back into management, and yet he's sitting there digging out a fellow manager and praising an owner who's got a vacancy. Funny that, isn't it? Really, really sort of coincidental, I assume. I don't know if he's bitter or something, but everything Rafa has said about his time at Newcastle, it ties into what everyone else has said about Mike Ashley. It's not an outlier. It's not a revelation, really. Some of the details are pretty staggering, but overall, it fits into the narrative of what we know about Mike Ashley. He thought he would be given significant control of transfers, and he wasn't. He thought he'd be given investment into the squad, as in fresh investment, not just money from players sold, and he wasn't. The goalposts did move. When Nolan says the goalposts didn't move, I think he's being revisionist. I think he's just saying what he thinks is true. And look, we all get things wrong sometimes, but it feels like he's a long way off the mark here. Every transfer window, Benitez felt undermined. And I'll tell you what, where the proof of the pudding is for me. If Ashley thought Benitez was lying, you know, when he used to say in press conferences the difficulties he was having, that there wasn't any money, Ashley could have sacked him. He could have said to Rafa, "Sorry, mate, you're lying about what I've been saying behind the scenes, and I feel that's completely unacceptable. You have to go. I'll get someone else in who will cooperate with me more." But he didn't. And that was the proof of it to me, is that Ashley kept a bloke at his club who kept saying what a terrible owner he was, even in veiled terms. But he kept hinting at it. And yet Ashley wouldn't get rid of him because he knew he was right. If I'm honest, I think Rafa's done well to get out of there. And I think the next man who takes over has got a tough old job to do at Newcastle. And I don't envy them at all. But there are people out there who want the job, it turns out. There's no one, by the way, who I think should take that job. But there is a Nolan who I think will take that job. And I think that's why Kevin Nolan's out there talking the way he's talking. Because in the same way that Rio Ferdinand came out and defended Mike Ashley because he's got quite a significant business interest with him, and why wouldn't you come out and defend your mates? I think that's what Kevin Nolan's doing, the former Leyton Orient, former Notts County manager and former Newcastle midfielder, the bloke with the weird dance. I think he actually wants to be Newcastle manager, and I think that's pretty transparent, because if you listen to that whole interview, literally 10 minutes before he started talking about Mike Ashley, he was talking about how difficult it is to get back into management, how he sent in CVs and not got jobs, or gone to interviews and not got jobs. This is his audition for the Newcastle job. I tell you what, Kevin, you should have a little look at Twitter this morning. Because I'll be honest, if I was going to become Newcastle manager, I might think, I wonder what sort of reception I'll get there. If Kevin Nolan got the Newcastle job, I guarantee you he would be booed at every single home game. After what he said today, and after what he knows about the fans and Mike Ashley. The funny thing is, I don't think Mike Ashley wants someone to defend him in public. I don't think Mike Ashley cares. If he's cared before, he would have done something about it. But he clearly doesn't. So what Kevin Nolan has done is simultaneously put himself in the running and rule himself out of the race for the Newcastle job. Whether he's qualified to do it doesn't really matter. Because you don't have to be qualified for jobs these days in football, do you? You just have to be someone. If you want to be Chelsea manager, you only have to have 1 year's experience. I am 1 year away from having the prerequisite amount of managerial experience to get the Chelsea job. But actually, when you think about Chelsea, and this is what I began with, Chelsea fans and Newcastle fans, it's the same. Why would any sane person take the Chelsea job right now? You've got no job security. You've got no ability to improve the squad. You've got an owner who seems uninterested in the club itself. You've got a technical director who's brand new in the job. I don't know why you get involved with it. But this is the thing. Football fans. What's fan short for? Fanatic. And that's what Frank Lampard is. He's not sane in this case. He's completely blinded by his love of Chelsea. I don't blame him for that. But it's the same. Anyone who takes the Newcastle job will be blinded by love for the club. And that's what Rafa had for 3 years. It's what Lampard will have for as long as he's at the club. That's football. We all make mistakes.
Love Sports.
Time to talk a bit of Manchester United, because it's that time of the week where Love Sports Manchester United columnist Tom Wade talks us through his thoughts about United this week. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, James. How are you?
Yeah, getting on well, mate. I understand that you're concerned about the defence, which, frankly, most Manchester United fans have been for, well, I would say about 3 years. we think that this Harry Maguire deal might come through in the next couple of days or weeks, but if it doesn't, who else are you looking at to try and strengthen that back line?
Well, James, I made it quite clear that, you know, I'm one of those that thinks United simply have to strengthen at the back. The talks on Harry Maguire seem to be going well. I've heard that there's been a bid, United have bid 75 million plus about 5 million in add-ons, to which City have said, no thanks, we're not going to rival. So it would seem that they're pretty much unrivaled now in the pursuit of Harry Maguire. Whether that deal gets done, I believe it will get done, but certainly not before Monday when the squad fly out to Australia. But alternatively, if it doesn't come through, and I'm completely wrong, it is known, of course. Trying to keep track of Manchester United's, it's like gold dust. It's hard to come by, really. You won't find anybody that really knows what's concretely going on right now.
Mm.
I put together an article this week that focuses on who I believe they should target. Obviously, you've got the Koulibaly in there. I think he is probably one of the best defenders right now in the world, not only Europe. Obviously, he had a strong campaign with Napoli last season, named Serie A best defender. I think that speaks for itself, because, let's be honest, the Italian league is a really tough league, probably not as much as the Premier League, but it's very, very much worth looking at that. We've also got the young Portuguese centre-back at Benfica, Ruben Dias. Dias, he really sought to fame in Portugal's under-19 European Championship, where unfortunately they were knocked out at the semi-final stage, the eventual winner of the match. However, I still believe he is one player that United, pretty much suits United. You know, he's young. Okay, he's not British, which all he is obviously trying to push at the moment. But, you know, his CV at the moment is phenomenal. When you look at it, you know, he's got 9 caps for Portugal. He's highly spoke about in Portugal. The man himself, Cristiano Ronaldo, is a very big fan of him.
Tom, would you not be worried about signing a 22-year-old centre-half to go straight into the first team from a league where he doesn't have to do a lot of defending? You know, I remember going to watch Benfica a couple of years ago when they still had Victor Lindelof and Edison in goal, and they conceded some awful goals because they're not used to having to do much defending. Would it not concern you if United end up paying £60 million for a lad who hasn't realistically got that much experience?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's a concern, but that's when the next plan comes in together. You come and get yourself a Ruben Dias, and then you bring in somebody like Toby Alderweireld. It's quite clear his contract is out at the end of the season. I don't see Spurs giving him another deal. He's got a £25 million release clause. If I was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I would have made that happen at the soonest point possible. And then you bring a player like Alderweireld into the team, he can slot straight in, he's a solid defender, he knows the Premier League, he's a proven veteran of the Premier League. And not only that, it gives you time then to, you know, bed Diaz in. Let him come in and bed him in, and then obviously it opens up the door for Axel Twente, who may find a new contract, so he'll be sticking around. And it gives chances to players like that to develop. And obviously the experience gets transferred through.
Do you want to see them sign Diaz and Alderweireld and Maguire even? Are we looking at a triple centre-half signing this summer?
I shouldn't think so, no. I mean, if you know, the Maguire deal, that comes through, of course, everything I've just said completely goes out the window because, let's be honest, the budget isn't there now. You know, the FFP is so tight, there's only so much money you can take in, bring out, and it gets complicated. But I would say, personal opinion, I would really go down the route of maybe looking at a Diaz and an Alderweireld, because you get two defenders in, one for now and potentially a few more years, and then you get one that pretty much could slot into the team and give him the experience. And of course, you get two for the price of one. You know, Harry Maguire, what are you talking? Like I just said, 75 million plus five million in add-ons, but you know, whether that's truthful, we could say it ends up being about 85, and then you're thinking, well, 25 for Alderweireld, 56 in the Diaz contract as well. You are really getting a bit of a better deal, in my opinion.
Certainly seems that way. Speaking of deals, I'm sure you will have been gratified to see United trying again to get a deal done for David De Gea. How do you feel about that deal? In your bones, do you feel they're going to get a contract done with David De Gea?
I feel De Gea will sign the contract. I think it's pretty much going to be signed. I mean, £150,000 a week. You know, he'll be the richest goalkeeper in world football. I think that's enough in itself to convince him to sign. I mean, De Gea last season, he wasn't a David De Gea we used to see him, and that was quite clear. But again, that stems from, he was getting a pound in, week out, because there was nothing in front of him. But we all know, you put a decent defence in front of David De Gea, and you are going to stand a chance. So I believe he will re-sign, and I think that'll be another positive for United. You know, he's got his contract's at the end of the year, it's done. If he doesn't sign the deal, then I wouldn't be surprised to see him leave.
You must be slightly relieved, though, to see someone like Dean Henderson, who's obviously a talented goalkeeper. We saw him with the under-21. So it's not all doom and gloom for Manchester United, even if David De Gea does leave. Tom, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for coming on. As always, that's Love Sports Manchester United columnist Tom Wade. Remember, you can read him every Friday at 4 o'clock on lovesportradio.com. Now, it would be remiss of me not to mention the sad news you will have heard in the headlines breaking in the last couple of hours, that John McCririck has sadly passed away at the age of 79. He was a man who was a friend of Love Sport. He came on the station regularly, always a great guy to have to talk about horse racing. And it was sad news, irrespective. The thing with John is that he divided opinion, because he was an eccentric. You know, the sight of him in his deerstalker, his glasses, the rings, the cape or whatever that weird coat was, it was synonymous with horse racing for a long, long time. And you know, his bulletins were frantic, he filled with that incomprehensible tic-tac, almost reflexive. It looked like he had a twitch, he couldn't stop himself doing it. It was kind of mystifying how he was so popular, but he was. And if you go back far enough, you'll find him brandishing that enormous cigar as well, until TV producers finally decided that wasn't really okay anymore. And you know, he was never short of an opinion. You know, whether it was horse racing or, you know, the going at Cheltenham this year or even gender politics. And probably the latter didn't always make him a popular figure. In fact, I know a lot of people who didn't like him at all. He was always a controversial one. And sometimes that's quite difficult to do consistently without actually being exorcised from the circle of public life. And he found himself as a bit of a celebrity. And yet he always kept coming back. You know, John McCrick never really went away. Sadly, he has now gone away for good. And he's the kind of character who we will always miss. It was nice to hear him talk on Love Sport a few months ago about coming back as a racehorse called the Fat Slug. Well, you know what? I'm not allowed to endorse gambling, but if in a couple of years you see the Fat Slug on a race card at Chepstow on a Thursday night, it might just be worth a sentimental couple of quid.
This is Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show here on Love Sport Radio. It's the Friday edition, which means I've got my stand-in producer and he's doing his best with the buttons. He's getting it. Honestly, I mean, Ben's so incompetent that you couldn't be any worse, quite frankly. We don't even follow him on Twitter. That was a personal favourite item of the day. Someone from the Love Sport Twitter account has unfollowed my producer, Ben. It's the sort of social media equivalent of a P45, I suppose. Take the hint, Ben. Won't see you on Monday. I actually won't see him on Monday. I'm literally not here. Nick Kyrgios. Should we talk about him? Love him or hate him, he's box office, isn't he? He was playing Rafa Nadal yesterday, and you can't help but watch him. And it doesn't even matter that Kyrgios once beat Nadal at Wimbledon, because obviously that adds an extra frisson. But really? Kyrgios is just total box office. He's got this ability to play one of the best shots any tennis player can ever hit, followed by some of the worst and most bad-tempered, childish tennis anyone could create. It's kind of fabulous to see, and it does keep you on the edge of your seat, doesn't it? The Australian was in sort of typically grumpy form yesterday. The best way I can describe it, it was like a petulant child almost throughout. He took on, of course, his arch-nemesis in Rafa Nadal. And it's not just a rivalry, this. It's not as though they've played each other a lot. It's not as though they've come across each other a particularly large amount. Actually, it's a complete oil versus fire. There's no way it cannot end in something explosive. If you start with Nadal, he, from the age of dot, was a ball monkey. Always a guy who hit loads of balls. His uncle Tony recognised from an early age that he could play left-handed and so made him do it. And he just hit ball after ball after ball, hundreds if not thousands a day. And he's done that for the best part of 30 years. That's been his life, hitting tennis balls and trying to get better and better and grind. He relishes the training. He was one of the most athletic and sort of most bulky players on tour for a long time. And that made him different. It set him apart. He didn't have the natural ability. Sure, he produced some unbelievable tennis, but he didn't always have that natural ability that others did. He likes the long matches. He likes the grind. But he's also OCD. Out of this world OCD. And, you know, he has to drink his water bottles at the same rate. He has to can't step on the lines. He cleans the lines when he's on clay. And it takes time out of tennis matches. Compare that to Kyrgios. He basically wants to spend as little time on the tennis court as possible. He plays tennis as though he's trying to avoid doing it. As though his mum's just said, well, you've got to play three sets, Nick, or you're not getting any doing. He's going, oh, fine, we'll just get it out of the way, just get it done, yeah, I'll just hit it. You know, like a grumpy teenager cleaning his room, just trying to rush it and throw everything under the bed. Which, actually, to be honest, I still do. But anyway, don't go under my bed. Never, ever go under my bed. It's a hellish zone, honestly. You'll find all sorts in there. Not that. But Kyrgios does just play at an enormous speed, and even the points are short, the way he plays is short. And when you then go and stick him on court with Nadal, and tennis is kind of a cooperative thing. You know, you can't play tennis on your own, can you? You sort of both have to cooperate to get a game done. And you put those two together, and it's inevitable. It's always going to be fireworks. And it didn't disappoint at all. Like, it was a massively interesting game of tennis to watch. Kyrgios complained pretty much from the first game about the pace of Nadal's play. And actually, and I won't say this very often, he's right. Nadal does break the rules on a regular basis. He goes over the number of seconds he's allowed to take between points. He doesn't get up from his chair straight away or even on time. He regularly gets very close to, if not actually breaking, the rules. There was one point when Nadal stopped Kyrgios as he was about to serve because he wasn't ready. And that's a straight up, that's just not how tennis works. The game is supposed to be played at the pace of the server. And if the server is ready, you should be ready too. And I did actually feel sorry for Kyrgios when he said to the umpire, well, look, he's not allowed to stop me there. You shouldn't stop me there. And the umpire said, I'll stop you when I want to stop you. And like, Kyrgios is a classic sort of type A personality in that sense, where as soon as someone told him what to do, he just went off on one. And he started saying to the umpire, classic moment, looking up at the chair going, oh, do you feel powerful? Are you powerful up there? You up on your chair? Do you like being up there on the chair? You powerful? And then he walks past, you know, the umpire's chair and goes, like he's got a shock from the power of the chair. It was childish, but it was fun to watch. And he even hit Nadal. Nadal up at the net, as he's doing a little bit more later in his career, he even hit him and didn't put his hand up to apologise, which your sport is supposed to do as a mere courtesy. He was obviously questioned about it.
But why would I apologise? I won the point.
He didn't look too pleased.
And?
What? But you seemed to wind him up, and then he
I don't care. Why would I apologise?
No, but he does care. Of course he doesn't apologise, because he knows it'll wind Rafa Nadal up. And Kyrgios knows that part of his allure and part of his skill is his ability to wind people up. It's like Diego Costa. Diego Costa doesn't apologise when he goes in late on someone, but that's part of his game. The whole point of Diego Costa and Nick Kyrgios is to pressurise people by getting under their skin. And that point, by the way, where he hit Nadal, it's a completely legitimate tactic. You see it in doubles quite a lot, where you get, you know, close exchanges at the net. But if you can't hit it to someone's right, you can't hit it to someone's left, and you don't think you can hit it over them, it's the only thing to do is hit it as hard as you can, straight at them, and hope that they can't get out of the way. And it's not like you hit Nadal in the face or the eye, which is probably the only place you can really damage, well, maybe not the only place you can damage someone with a tennis ball. If he'd hit him in the nads or in the eye, yeah, stick a hand up. And actually, anyone else, stick a hand up anyway, just because it's what you do. But Kyrgios is just like, yeah, well, why would I stick a hand up? But he's not as badass as he thinks he is, because actually, this is all part of his game. He didn't not put a hand up because he doesn't care. He didn't put a hand up because it's Nadal, and he doesn't like him, and he can't control his emotions on court. And that's what you see with Kyrgios most of the time, is that he can't control his emotions on court. He doesn't have the mental stability to deal with it. And actually, he probably doesn't have the mental stability to ever be a top player. And the most frustrating thing, maybe of all, is that he knows it.
I know what I'm capable of. Just depends how much I'm a great tennis player, but I don't do the other stuff. You know, I'm not the most professional guy. I won't train day in, day out. I won't show up every day. So there's a lot of things I need to improve on to get to that level that, you know, Rafa brings, Novak brings, Roger have been doing for so long. So it just depends how bad I want it. But no, at the moment, I don't think I can contend for a Grand Slam.
He can't. He's absolutely right. He can't contend for a Grand Slam. And yes, there's an honesty there by saying I don't do all the things I need to do to be a great tennis player. But that doesn't make it better. Sure, that honesty is refreshing. And sure, he's still talented. But I don't think any of us sit there and go, oh yeah, it's so great that Nick says doesn't work hard enough at tennis. We'd all much rather, by the way, that he did work hard at his tennis and he took this amazing serve, brilliant hand-eye, fantastic athleticism, and turned it into a Grand Slam-winning tennis player. He's got raw materials that the likes of Djokovic, Federer and Nadal would kill to have. Absolutely kill to have. I don't know if there is a player if you take the top three out of it, because I think they're in a different league, in the top 50, I don't know if there is another player with as much natural talent as Nick Kyrgios. I really don't. I look at someone like Kyle Edmund and think he can let it loose. He's got that forehand that quite a lot of people are jealous of. Kyle Edmund himself thinks he has the best forehand in world tennis. Don't necessarily know if that's true, but, you know, he's got a lot of that natural ability. Denis Shapovalov, maybe, the Canadian, kind of young guy with that sort of talent. But there really aren't many who've just got that sheer hand-eye to be able to overcome almost anyone in the world on their day. And that's what's frustrating about it. But is Nick good for tennis? You know, and that's a fair question, and one that often gets asked. And on a basic level, and I've covered tennis for a number of years. It's my first year not at Wimbledon in a while this year, and it's stinging a little bit. But I intrinsically don't like Nick Kyrgios. I think he's rude. I think he's arrogant. I think he unfairly and unreasonably calls out journalists. He was asked in his press conference last night whether he regretted going to the pub until 11:30 the night before taking on Nadal. He went, no. You look pretty excited to ask that question. You must have a dull little life. It was just like, why do that to someone? Like, you're a multi-millionaire who makes money sitting there being asked questions. And you're being asked a question by a journalist, probably a skint journalist, because we all are, whose job it is to ask questions. Everyone is there to do their job, mate. Your job is not to humiliate people in press conferences. So for that reason, I intrinsically don't like him. But is he good for tennis? He just might be. Because people watch him, and we need that. He sells tickets, and let's face it, outside of the top three, not many people sell tickets like he does. He's a personality. We need that. It's always valuable. And realistically, you know what the biggest thing is? He's not doing it on a Sunday. He's not doing it on a Saturday. Because he's not there. We need guys like Nick Kyrgios to get to the third round and bomb out. Or get to the second round and bomb out. Because at that stage, it's something different. You know, while the top seeds are making their way through and there's maybe the odd upset and that's great. Yeah, it's nice to have a couple of other weird stories about Nick Kyrgios. But come the second week of a Grand Slam, what do you hear from Nick Kyrgios? Come the quarterfinals, the semifinals, what do you hear from Nick Kyrgios? The square root of nothing, because he's not there. Because he's been to two Grand Slam quarterfinals in his life. He is not an elite tennis player. He's a guy with elite level talent, but he's never been in the top 10. He's never been to the last four of a Grand Slam. So yeah, Nick Kyrgios is great for tennis because he's only a small percentage of it.
Love sports.
It's not often that the Premier League champions spend £62 million on a player and it kind of goes under the radar. But that's kind of what's happened with Rodri. I don't know why. Maybe it's with all the Tanguy and Ndombele stuff, Tottenham actually buying a player. I'm not sure, but I feel like Rodri has flown under the radar a little bit, just as he probably did when he was 16 at Atletico and he was released for not being big enough. Well, he's 6'2" now and £62.8 million worth of midfielder at Manchester City. Let's find out a little bit more about him. Dave Cartledge, editor at ESPN UK, is here to tell us more. Dave, do you think Rodri has gone under the radar? And if so, why? Is he a sort of unspectacular player?
Yeah, I think it's due to the type of player that he actually is. I think if he was a winger, if he was a striker, then I think, more explosive, shall we say, then I think that there might have been more said about him. But yeah, because of his position, he's just a little sitting, holding midfielder who does the simple things very, very well. But I think he's a very, very special player. And I'm sure he'll pick up a lot of attention very soon.
He's obviously being tipped as the man to replace Fernandinho. Do you think he can reach those levels? Because Fernandinho is simultaneously the most overrated and underrated player in the Premier League.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think Fernandinho has been outstanding. He's one of those players who hold the team together. But I think Rodri can surpass him. Rodri definitely can be world class. He can be the best in his position. I think in his position, there's only Sergio Busquets, who is the main man for that role. But I think he can potentially reach that level, or maybe just off it.
Given how good you think he is, were you surprised that City were pretty much the only ones in for him? That there wasn't more competition?
There was more clubs in for him. Bayern Munich were in for him right until the end. And look, Man United also asked about him in January. But the fact is that City were the ones who said, like, look, we want to pay the clause, and they did it. So Atleti had three or four teams actually say to them, look, we're going to pay the clause. But nobody did. And then City decided to, because Pep Guardiola has a mentality of, if he sees a player that he wants, who he believes will improve the team, he tells City to go out and buy him. And that's exactly what has happened here.
As Atletico lose one, they also gain one. João Felix, just the 113 million quid. Pretty choice numbers. Worth it?
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy fee. But I think, Atleti are looking at this in terms of him being, he can reach, Mbappe type levels and be that youngster who everybody looks to. But also, It's at Leti, so they're looking already at the market continuing to blow, and who knows, in maybe 2 years yet time, 3 years time, they're selling them for 250, 300 million. That might sound a little bit ludicrous, but I don't really see it as that way. I think the market's going that way.
And he's obviously, he's 19, he's got one cap for Portugal, he's barely played for Benfica, quite frankly. What is it that's alerted him, to his talents? He got 20 goals in 40-odd games last season for Benfica. I assume that's the main thing, is it?
Yeah, that was extraordinary what he did. And the club, they're looking at a young player with immense talent who they believe they can progress on, make into a world-class player. They've done it before as well. They've bought young players before and turned them into somebody very, very special. Look at Sergio Aguero, probably one of the best strikers to ever play in the Premier League. You know, that all started out with Atleti bringing him over from South America, and he's very, very young. And they're going to do the same here, I think. They've got such a fantastic track record, and I think we're going to be talking, I think everyone's going to be talking about João Félix inside 2 years.
You mentioned Mbappe there. Is he that sort of player? Is he a pacey winger, or is he more of a forward? Where do you think is his best position?
I think he best plays as a second striker. So he will play potentially off Alvaro Morata or Diego Costa. And he'll help create, but he'll also score. He'll work in the wide areas as well. He's capable of doing a lot of things because of his skill set. He's very skillful, got excellent technique, he's got excellent pace. I think, along with Mbappe, we're potentially looking at two of the most exciting young players in the world.
And speaking of exciting players and Atletico Madrid strikers specifically, this Antoine Griezmann stuff with Barcelona sounds pretty fascinating. His release clause, if I understand it right, dropped by 70-odd million quid, but there was a chance that Barcelona appeared to have agreed terms with him many, many months ago and then just waited to do the deal until now. Does that seem likely? I mean, it sounds pretty illegal to me, doesn't it?
I think that's precisely what's happened. Look, a lot of things going on in football that aren't actually reported, out there, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if Barcelona did something like that. There's other things that, these things just go on, and it just doesn't surprise me at all. Look, Antoine Griezmann once had an agreement with Manchester United, and then the transfer ban came in force at Atletico Madrid, and he decided to stay. So, it doesn't surprise me if he's had an agreement.
And I suppose, to that extent, nothing's over until the fat lady sings, is it? You're saying that essentially in transfer businesses, and you'll know this much better than I do, it's never done until it's done. Just because a player says he wants to go somewhere doesn't mean it.
Yeah, there's always a last, honestly, nothing. You can't take anything for granted these days. I think, anything can happen until that player is on the official website holding up the shirt, I think that's how it has to be. But look, I think by the end of July, Antoine Griezmann will be a Barcelona player.
Well, he'll do a decent job there, I'm sure. He's one of my favourite players to watch, that's for sure. But he'll probably make a nice documentary about joining Barcelona, just like he did or didn't last time, which was...
I'm sure. he loves these documentaries.
Yeah, it's embarrassing if you ask me, but that's just my opinion. Dave, thanks very much for joining us. Dave Carlidge there, editor at ESPN.co.uk. So many players going for such big money that, imagine, 63 million quid for a bloke we've basically never heard of. I can't quite understand why this money keeps going. Eventually, this market has to run out. Surely at some point, we have to bottom out. I just don't see it happening anytime soon. If Atletico Madrid, and Dave alluded to it there, are still prepared to pay 113 million quid for a 19-year-old who's had one decent season in what is, quite frankly, an extremely poor league, I mean, the sky's the absolute limit. They must be expecting to sell him on for absolutely enormous money later on down the line. Now, slightly less money flying around at Derby County. They, of course, have just lost Frank Lampard. They are no longer called Frank Lampard's Derby County, which is disappointing. I was enjoying that name. They are now just Derby County. We might start calling them Philip Cocu's Derby County. Maybe it's just my age, the specific generation I am, but when Derby got Philip Cocu as manager, I went, hang on, what, that Philip Cocu? Because I remember him as a player, and he was mercurial. Like, he's a proper player. In that great Netherlands side, I say that great Netherlands side, they never achieved anything, but they really should have been very good, and they had a lot of good players. He was obviously brilliant at Barcelona in the late 90s and early 2000s as well. That's probably when most people remember him. And he's got probably one of the more unorthodox coaching CVs. He was assistant manager at the Netherlands for 4 years. He then was PSV, Fenerbahce and now Derby County, which is not the ordinary way of doing it. But he came through the system, I suppose you might say, as a coach at PSV, a club where he had two different spells as a player. And he was very successful at PSV Eindhoven as well. Three league titles and a Dutch Cup got them into the knockout stages of the Champions League as well. And he also helped develop the likes of Steven Bergwijn, Jurgen Lacadia, who are not household names necessarily, but decent players, and he will have had a part in those. And he'll also have tremendous contacts within the game because of where he's played and because of where he's managed. Not just in the Netherlands, but in Spain as well. He's been over in Turkey. I think it's a very interesting signing. And quite frankly, you have to wonder whether Derby have upgraded from Frank Lampard. I know Frank Lampard's a talented guy, and I know that he's got exceptional knowledge of football, but he doesn't have that level of coaching that Philip Kocu does. Okay, he had a poor spell at Fenerbahce, but the Turkish league is a pretty unique place, and he himself in particular is a unique manager. And sometimes these things don't work out, but at least he spent time managing football clubs. And like Lampard at Chelsea, he knew PSV very well, and that helped him. And now he's going into a brand new setup. He's going to have to bring in pretty much a brand new coaching setup. He's got a four-year contract, by the way. I mean, honestly, who gives a manager a like, when they actually say, yeah, we're going to sign you up till 2023, what manager thinks, yeah, I'm going to spend 4 years here? In English football, I think there's only maybe about seven managers in the entirety of English league football who have been there for more than 4 years. It might not even be as many as seven. You know, Jim Bentley, Sean Dyche, Mauricio Pochettino. Benitez is gone now. Jurgen Klopp's very high up that list. Gareth Ainsworth at Wycombe Wanderers, very high up that list as well. Realistically, Koku's not going to be there for 4 years. What it really says is, if we sack you, it's going to be expensive. That's essentially what that contract says. Mel Morris, the man who runs Derby, says we're delighted to welcome Koku as our new manager. Develop our philosophy. Don't know what that means. It's football. Philosophy is not a thing in football. From the first conversation with Philip and his team, it was very clear they share similar views. The fit is strong. We want to build on the momentum we have in our style of play, our club values, and the increasingly important role of our academy. I think that's where the key lies. When you look at the type of manager Lampard was, someone who likes young players. Someone who likes working with young players. Koku, similarly, I think he's only 48 off the top of my head. It's also written on a piece of paper in front of me, so that massively helps. But it does make me look very knowledgeable. He should be able to work a bit more with young players. And when you look at the systems he's worked in, you know, he came through at AZ Alkmaar, I think. As I mentioned, played at PSV. He's seen the way Barcelona work. He's worked at the PSV system as well. He's worked within the national team system of the Netherlands, and we all know how many players they've brought through. So he will bring with him a tremendous amount of experience when it comes to turning young players into first-team players. And I think, to a larger extent, that's the key in modern football. Most clubs now have extensive scouting networks, and who you get kind of depends on how much money you have. You can't really sort of discover players anymore, because everyone, there's so much information out there that everyone knows everyone. It's very rare to discover a player who's already better than anything you could have bought, because someone with more money will just buy him, right? But what you can do is upgrade players. You can produce them with your own academy and upgrade them. Or you can buy them at 22 and turn them into something they're not. Or you can buy them at 29 and turn them into something they're not. As a coach, I think it's the biggest thing you can offer when you go into a job interview. If you can go in with a CV and say, here's a list of 10 players who came to my club, either from the academy or from outside, and I took them from being this sort of player to this sort of player, and I improved them. That's what modern coaching is. It's babysitting, a bit, and it's player development. It's not about being someone like a Brian Clough and a Peter Taylor, going and finding a player and finding someone that no one else had ever really rated. It's actually, and this is the other side, the Brian Clough, Peter Taylor thing, I suppose, it's finding a player and fixing their problems. That's what they used to do. They'd find a player, go, oh, right, you're a gambler. Well, let's fix that, and then you'll become a better player. And they did. With modern football, it's, right, well, you're a good player, but you can't use your left foot. Well, let's change that. Let's improve the way you look at the game. Let's change your position. let's move you, Declan, because we don't really think you're a very good centre-half, but you might actually work as a centre midfielder. Whoever it was, and I've never seen anyone given any credit for this, and if you know, give me a text on 0208 7025 58. I want to know who the bloke who moved Declan Rice from centre-half to centre-mid was, because whoever he is going to make West Ham about £100 million one day, and I think he deserves a bit of commission.
This is Love Sport.
Plenty of BS to clean up, as always, today, and most of it's coming out of the mouth, nose and ears of Marko Arnautović. Honestly, Marko Arnautović, I ranted a fair bit about Marko in January, because I wasn't terribly impressed by his behaviour, by his agent and brother, Daniil, by his behaviour, and by the fact that he eventually said, no, I'll stay and I'll have a new contract as well. That was pretty transparent. And I think anyone who had even a shred of respect for Marko Arnautović must surely have lost it now. Because for the second time in 7 months, he's gone to his employers and said, I want to go. I'm ready to go. I mean, how can you put up with that as a club? It's not even the first time it's happened at West Ham. They went through this with Dimitri Payet as well, not so long ago. And frankly, Dimitri Payet had a lot more reason to do it than Marko Arnautović. Because I think you'll find that no one rates Marko Arnautović's abilities more than West Ham fans. I don't think many other clubs look at him and go, oh, we'd have him here. Because, yeah, sure, he's played at a high level. Obviously, won some things. Spent a little bit of time at Inter Milan. But realistically, he's not a world beater. He's not someone who's won multiple Champions Leagues or scored goals left, right and centre. He's only just snuck into double figures each year at West Ham. And he takes penalties. Oh, no, of course he doesn't take penalties. Mark Noble takes them, doesn't he? But he's definitely, I'm sure he's got a couple on there. I'll have to check that. But either way, it's not an impressive goal-scoring record overall. And I just don't think that he's as good as he thinks he is, or as good as his brother thinks he is, put it that way. Hammer of the Year, 2 years ago. I don't think he'll be winning that award anymore. Throwing the hammers sign, you know, up to the crowd when he scores. So doing that video, which is clearly at gunpoint, saying, I'm sorry, I'm ready. And, you know, when Frank McAvenny comes on and says he wants him to rot in the reserves, I find it very hard to disagree with him.
The first time he wanted to go, I was wanting him out the door because we obviously, as ex-players, you hear your stories, and apparently it's not good for the dressing room. And this coming up second time, then the boys will just be fed up with him, I would imagine. Mm. And the quicker it goes, the better. I would love West Ham to put him in the reserves and just let him sit there and stew and you know, every attitude that he's got to the club, but it's not going to happen. It's a business now, and Mr. Sullivan and Gold will be wanting to reap some money in for him. So I think the next week or so they'll be trying to offload him.
And I think they will. They will want to get their money's worth for him. They rejected a bid on Tuesday of £19 million, are looking to get closer to £23 or £24 million. But they're sick of him. Everyone at West Ham is sick of Marko Arnautović. And honestly, how as a player does that make you feel? If you're someone, and look, he's a passionate guy. I know he is. He's represented his country 81 times. Football is his life. It gives him, his brother, a job as his agent. It gives him his livelihood. It makes everything that is his life. And he's still viewed in Austria, I think, as a bit of a bad boy. And I don't know how he can get away from that image now. He's going to go to China now and make loads of money and fine. But what's his legacy as a footballer? How is he going to be remembered? In 10 years' time, when someone says the name Marko Arnautović to you, what are you going to remember? Are you going to remember playing for Stoke for a long period of time in the lower reaches of the Premier League and then leaving when it looked like they might start to have to battle for relegation? Probably. But are you going to remember the fact that he scored 22 goals? No one cares. Because what you've done, Marko, is just urinated all over your legacy. If any West Ham fan, say all those West Ham fans who voted you Hammer of the Year 2017 to 2018, which doesn't sound like the most prestigious award ever, but there are some serious names who've won that award. Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst, Billy Bonds, Teddy Sheringham, Joe Cole, Julian Dix, you know, guys who will go down in history of West Ham Football Club as people who gave their all for that club, what are your 2 years going to show for you? Honestly, what are your 50-odd appearances and 21 goals going to leave you with? I don't think they're going to leave you with anything other than a sour taste in the mouth of every West Ham fan who has to say your name, every single West Ham fan who's ever sung your name. Because what you've done is shown that you're a complete charlatan, that no one can trust a single word you've said. So even for that first season when you arrived and West Ham fans got a bit excited because you once played for Inter Milan and got a bit excited because they thought you were a quality Premier League and Bundesliga player, all those fans are going to think, no, you know what, Marco, you were never worth it. We could have had someone actually who cared about West Ham playing up front for us. And instead, we had you, who it turns out was just there for a quick buck to prolong your Premier League career, to avoid going down to the Championship with Stoke, and to make sure that you would still be able to go to China at the end of your career and make a load of money. Now, I don't deny that footballers are mercenary, and they all are, and that's the nature of it. But don't pretend that you're not. If you are someone to whom money and money alone matters, don't come up and say, oh, I'm a real West Ham fan. I'm a hammer. I'm doing the hammer's sign. Don't do that, because it's completely disingenuous and it's a transparent lie. And I don't ever want to see someone like that play in the Premier League. If he had stood up like Nick Kyrgios and said, you know what, I don't really like football. I'll try hard because I'm paid to do it, but mostly I want to make a lot of money while I'm a footballer. If he had said that, I would have a modicum of respect for him. But as it is, he stood up and repeatedly said, I really care about West Ham Football Club. I really care about these fans, about playing here, about coming on you Irons. I really care about that. But he doesn't. It's transparently true. And it's that kind of disingenuity that makes me really angry in football. Money, I don't mind footballers making lots of money. I get that it happens. But when they claim that that's not what they care about, that does make me really angry. Loyalty? What loyalty?
Love Sport.
And another bastion of the British sporting calendar starts tomorrow. The Tour de France kicks off in Belgium, I believe, which obviously makes no sense whatsoever. But, you know, they've done it in weirder places, I suppose. Last year's winner, Geraint Thomas, says he feels no pressure to defend the title. Despite, obviously, a difficult build-up, he crashed in last month's Tour de Suisse. Joining us now is cycling journalist Dane Cash. Dane, thanks very much for coming on the show. How big a chance does Geraint Thomas have of defending his title?
He's still the top or second favourite overall. I mean, he's still got a great chance of defending his title, I think.
The team itself, obviously, different name, same team. Will he have a joint leader situation? I mean, that sounds dangerous, doesn't it?
It does. That's sort of the same situation that he was in last year, but last year he was the sort of second guy, the up-and-comer, and ended up winning the race. This year he's the defending champion, that second guy, Egan Bernal, young Colombian, is only riding in his second Tour de France, but he's one of the best climbers in the world. He's got a lot of people very excited, and unlike Thomas, he's had a really great season, and Thomas has just had kind of a quiet season, has not had the follow-up he was hoping for after winning the Tour last year.
Can you put your finger on perhaps why that there was that crash at the Tour de Suisse? I mean, that happens, that's a sort of occupational hazard, but if he's also not winning races, is there any reason why he's not performing to the level he was last year?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. The crash is a big one. I mean, that's a big part of it. For him, I think he was content to take it a little more slowly this year. Coming off the Tour win, he enjoyed himself in the off season, and I don't think he was feeling particularly pressured to go out and win races early in the year. I think he was just kind of planning on working his way into shape and showing it off this past month here at the Tour de Suisse, which is one of the two big build-up races for the Tour, and he crashed out of that. So, you know, he might have been in perfect form by then, and we just don't know. That's the problem. There's a big question mark. We just don't really have a great sense of where he is.
You mentioned Egan Bernal and how everyone's quite excited about him. For perhaps occasional cycling fans, which obviously they come out of the woodwork for a couple of weeks every year in the summer, what makes Bernal such an exciting prospect?
So he's just 22 years old, which is extremely young for a Grand Tour overall contender. He would be the first 22-year-old in something like 30 years if he's able to win the Tour this year. He's an incredible climber. He's very, very good at going uphill, and that's kind of the number one thing for a Tour de France contender right now is you need to be a good climber. The mountains are where the differences are made. He's also not a bad time trialist, which is another important thing, and he's a decent bike handler, and he's just a bright guy. He really comes off as a very mature 22-year-old. So he has kind of the whole package, despite being so young and inexperienced.
The course, it always has a big influence on what sort of race we get at the Tour de France. I mean, my sort of very very rudimentary knowledge of cycling suggests that it doesn't look like there are that many stages in the Alps, far more in the other mountain ranges. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think they're pretty evenly split. Alps, Pyrenees, the Vosges has one stage that's going to be kind of tough this year. There is also one time trial. Those are where the differences are going to be made.
In terms of this Team Ineos switch, you know, it's not called Team Sky. Is it just a change of the name on the jersey, or have there been any more sweeping changes?
No, I think it's pretty much, at least in terms of racing strategy, in terms of, you know, what you see out on the road, it's a different jersey, but it's pretty similar what you're going to get in terms of the way this team races, and the personnel is pretty much the same as well.
If it's not Geraint Thomas, if it's not Egan Bernal, where should we be looking for the other challenges to come from?
That's a fantastic, that's the $1 million or the £1 million question, I guess, in tomorrow's British radio show here. Jakob Fuglsang's a big name. He's a guy who's kind of been knocking on the door for quite some time. He's 34 years old, but he's had a great season. Richie Port, Australian rider, sort of similar situation. He's been seen as a guy who could have won the Tour by now, hasn't done it. Nairo Quintana, I think, would be the other name to watch out for. Fellow Colombian, significantly more experienced than Bernal, has not quite put it together. Over his career, he's been kind of highly touted for several years. And I'll give you one more British name, Adam Yates. He and his brother Simon Yates will both be there. Adam is the leader of the team, the Mitchelton Scott team. And you know, his brother has had a ton of success already. Adam, not quite at that level yet in the 3-week races, but he's had some really good results so far this year. So a lot of people are pretty optimistic about his chances.
Dane, predictions always make journalists look silly. That's why I don't do them, and I make people who come on my show do them instead. Who do you think, if I had to ask you for one name, who'll be in yellow when they get to Paris on July 28th?
Yeah, I love predictions. They're fun. Why not? I'm thinking
because I'll play
Thomas
it back to you in 3 weeks, and you'll sound like an idiot. That's why they're not fun.
Yeah, Thomas is my pick. I think it is really hard. Bernal is looking so good, but I think Thomas just has the whole package, and I'm not terribly concerned about his kind of slow start to the year. I think he's going to be ready for this race. I do think Yates, though, is a really good person to keep an eye on, and I'm hoping we're going to get a good, exciting race this year. This whole very open, who knows who's going to win thing, that's not really what we've had at the Tour the last couple of years. So just the fact that nobody seems to have a great sense of who's going to win, that's a big win for everybody in terms of the fans, at least, going into the race.
Brilliant. Dane, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have someone who knows what they're talking about when it comes to cycling. Dane Cash there, cycling journalist. Geraint Thomas is going to win the Tour de France. No question in his mind, it would seem. But it will be a tight battle, I'm sure. I mean, that is the thing with Tour de France. If someone dominates it, it does take a little bit of the sting out, because once you're well ahead, you can track riders and you can just sort of let the race unfold in front of you and make sure nothing particularly bad happens to you. But when it's an open race, when it's tight, it can be really exciting going up those mountains.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.